This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show. This shares my interview and discussion with Town Council candidate Alan Earls. Our discussion was conducted via conference bridge to adhere to the social distancing requirements of this pandemic period. Franklin Mass voters should be aware that there will be a special election, per our town charter, to fill the seat recently vacated by Eamon McCarthy Earls. He left at the beginning of September to enter law school in Virginia. The special election is scheduled for Saturday, December 5, 2020, to meet the 90-day requirements of the town charter. Yes, we discussed that Alan is running to replace his son, Eamon. Alan answered the following set of questions, and all candidates for this position will be asked the same set of questions to provide a fair set of information for us as Franklin voters. The questions specifically will be listed in the show notes. The recording time of our conversation runs just about 35 minutes. So let's listen to my conversation with Alan. Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR-FM and on the Franklin radio dial in the local area at 102.9. Today we have Town Council candidate Alan Earls for the discussion in preparation for the special election coming up December 5th. Alan, welcome. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve.
I know you and I have seen each other at a number of Franklin events over the years. I remember moving the Historical Museum, where I think that was at the time I met Eamon. And now you're running to fill his spot. So that's a little interesting position. Usually the son takes the father's spot, and you've got the tables turned in that case.
It is, very much so. Yeah, he's a tough act to follow.
Indeed. So for the some of the Franklin folks listening, if they don't know, they may have heard of Eamon, but who's Alan? So by way of introducing yourself, what is your Franklin story?
Yeah, thanks. That's an open-ended question. As a former reporter, I know you have to watch out for those because people will talk for hours when you get a chance to. I'll try not to do that, but I will give you a pretty quick overview of me and how I got to Franklin, because I'm not born here. Right. To start at the beginning, I was born in central Massachusetts. I grew up west of Boston in Cochituate. I put myself through college working days and going nights to BU for quite a few years. Ultimately, earned a bachelor's degree with an English concentration. And then I stuck with that work by day, study by night pattern, and got a one-year post-grad program in management at Harvard Extension, and then attempted Suffolk Law, and that didn't work out great. And a first child was on the horizon, someone that you just mentioned. And I liked what I was doing as a writer and editor and decided to stick with that rather than going through all the pain of getting a law degree. Most of my career has been around writing, editing, and communication. But, you know, I had some earlier adventures. I was ahead of my time in the 1970s when I actually worked for a little company that was trying to build and sell electric cars. That didn't work out too well at the time, but it was interesting.
Back in the 70s, when I first moved to Franklin, wow.
Yeah, there was a desperate attempt back when, you know, fuel was $3 a gallon and people were making $1.50 an hour or whatever. It was interesting. Anyway, when I first came to Franklin, I think what really just made me decide I made the right choice was going to the Rome for dinner just after moving in. And I managed to forget my wallet. And that made me panic because I've been living in the Boston area. And I thought, oh my gosh, they're going to call the police. I'm going to be washing dishes for the whole night or whatever. But the waitress just said, no problem. Just come back when you can and pay it. So I thought, hey, wow, that's different. I like that. So pretty much looking for a way to fit in and contribute to the community from the get-go. I got involved with the Industrial Development Commission almost immediately. And the focus of that group at the time, I think it's been long since disbanded, was to try to attract business to some of the new industrial parks that were popping up to try to keep the tax burden off of homeowners. Mm-hmm. And I was working as editor of a business publication at the time, so I had some pretty potentially useful connections that could be useful for that.
Right.
And I also ended up helping to write and prepare some of the marketing material the town used. Through the 1980s and 1990s, again, as you know, Franklin was growing like crazy, and I was one of the people who started to get concerned about that. It's hard to recall when I first moved in, the parking lot was just being paved for the Stop and Shop Village Plaza, and Charles River Estates was just a farm field with tractors driving over it.
Right.
So when an open space committee was formed, I applied to join. We worked hard to figure out what open spaces still existed that might potentially be protected, and to try to come up with some options for the town. Then, as now, the issue is money, because it costs a lot of money to actually take land and preserve it most of the time, although there are, as you know, some government programs that can help, like the chapter 60,
I guess. 60 and 61, I think, are the two different categories. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. But in any case, we helped put in place some of the framework that helped encourage Ernie Delcart and family to donate that land, which is now named in his honor.
Yeah.
And that work got me involved with the SNET trail, which at the time was just completely overgrown and a nothing, and nobody really thought it was ever going to amount to anything. At the time, I organized the first intertown meeting to try to get people interested in connecting the bits between Bellingham and Franklin and so on. And that was ultimately adopted by Dave Labonte and the Franklin Odd Fellows, who got some muscle behind it. And then activists like Mark Kaplan came along and formed the Franklin Bellingham Rail Trail Committee, which has, of course, since then gone on to build the trail. I also helped launch the Earth Day cleanup, town cleanup, under the auspices of the Open Space Committee at the time, which Ryan Jetty at Recreation later adopted. And let's see, and I also became aware, early on when I looked at the maps, I saw this gigantic swath of federal land, the Charles River Natural Valley Storage Area, that nobody seemed to know or care much about. So I became, you know, very interested in preserving access to that. And eventually that led to language that preserved access through what is now the Brookview Condos. So there's a parking area for the public and a trail that connects to that area because of that early work, which we did. And you can shut me off from talking too much.
No. So just to Representative add Roy some color also, to that, that's where the former sewer plant was along, Pond Street?
Yes, right.
Yep. That access to what I think you're calling now, what is it, the Charles River watershed area?
Charles River Meadowlands initially is something I've subsequently started to, again, try to, you know, develop a consensus about how to better protect that amazing property, really.
It is.
And Representative Roy helped us get some funding to do a study of that, which was completed early this year, just in time for COVID season.
To kind of hit and disrupt that planning process.
Yeah, so we're not really doing anything with it right at the moment, but I hope when things get back to something more like normal that we can move along with some of the potential for that that area. And let's see, same time I also saw the rapidly disappearing farmland. My small contribution to, I hope, helping was getting an arts grant and producing a brochure cataloging all the existing farms in 2006 or so, I think it was, telling people how to get in touch with them, how to do business with them, a little bit of information about farm preservation and the sort of win-win in terms of keeping open space available, at least open vistas. And let's see, and of course, also, as you know, I'm kind of a history nut, so I was very involved in the town history from the get-go.
Yep.
And that's been enlarged, I guess. So you were, and I were talking before we started recording about your roots in the region. My wife Vicky's Italian, Irish, and French Canadian roots go back 5 generations in the town, so that's deepened further my interest in town history. I was on the historical commission for a few years, helped move the museum, as you mentioned, to its current location, and worked quite a few hours in the basement there, running computerizing some of the records and cataloging the things we had. And let's see,
archivist formally to do that.
Yes, I know, which is a blessing, because it's a lot of work.
It is.
And I wrote a book, Franklin Then and Now, in 2009,
yep,
published by Arcadia, with photos of the old Franklin, new Franklin, dealt with erosion problems at State Forest and what have you. Last but not least, I recently paid volunteer, mind you, to work for the census, U.S. Census, counting people in Franklin and in neighboring communities, which was actually a really great opportunity to meet people that you don't always meet, shall we say? You
know, absolutely.
Multi-family housing where sometimes people who are really struggling live, and getting a chance to talk to them was a great education, about the town, about them as people.
I can imagine. Yes. Yeah, you've got quite a history, no pun intended, by all means. And that industrial development piece, I think its current incarnation, we would call it the Economic Development Subcommittee for the town council.
Yeah, I think they do some of the same things.
Yes. Yeah. Similar scope, at least. Yes. Yep.
Right.
So another question, it's probably a good segue, in terms of the development over the open space, et cetera. So what degree of development do you feel is appropriate for Franklin? And then obviously within that, how would you balance the need for affordable housing, you know, with, you know, avoiding congestion, some of which we already have because of the way we've grown?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, all those issues are intertwined and not easy to unravel in real life,
which is why we want to have the conversation, because I know there's no sound bullets.
Yep, absolutely. Well, people who grew up here look back, you know, very nostalgically on when Franklin was a quiet town of 8,000 or 9,000 people. I think when I moved in, it was about 15,000. I would have been perfectly happy if it stopped growing right then and there. As I mentioned, it was still plenty of open space.
Sure.
But, you know, that's not realistic. People own land, they want to sell it so they can retire, so they can put their kids through college, or just because they want to make money.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot that can be done unless you have money to buy up the land, just because of the legal structure we have, property rights and so on. Having said that, I think we can do a whole lot more to work on the details. You know, local ordinances can help protect tree cover, historic stone walls and zoning back. I know the scenic byways law was put in place in the late 90s, which helped protect some of the roads that are, you know, have stone walls and lovely trees and so yep. on. That was a good start. And we've begun to be more supportive of farmers, though, again, perhaps too little too late, because economically it's really tough to do that. In fact, the town has managed to scoop up quite a few important parcels over the years. Lately, Brian Taberner, the town director of planning and development, has been doing a lot very quietly on the side. And, you know, again, I wish it were more, but the town has done some pretty important things. And on the built environment side, the design review committee has, I think, gotten us better looking structures. At least, you know, I guess an architect would argue the point, we just want to have everything look traditional in New England-y. But, you know, I think it's better than some of the alternatives, not just the instant strip malls that we were getting for a while.
Right.
But, you know, again, the whole Franklin's got a sad history of letting some of its best things be destroyed, whether it's natural features like the Franklin Gorge, which has been pretty much paved over and around, or human-made things like the Native American archaeological site that was destroyed in the creation of Beaver Pond back in the 1980s. And very much more recently, the Spanish-American War Monument on the Common was just trashed and destroyed. It's been put back in place because Dale Arnold and myself from Historical Commission made such an unholy stink about that. So it's now again part of our history and part of our mm-hmm. visual landscape. Yeah, and I think the specific issues that maybe you're getting to about growth relate to the fact that in a number of cases, I wouldn't want to try to take this to court, but some of the large private development projects have been approved in ways that do not seem to have aligned with the town's own stated policies.
Right.
But decision makers at a given moment succumb to either political pressure, maybe self-interest or whatever, and approve them anyway. So, you know, that's one problem. And on a related note, I think I haven't answered your question about housing, but looking back, we grew like crazy in the 80s and 90s, and we had a crisis because there weren't enough schools. Then we built schools like crazy, even though mm-hmm. you could look ahead and see that we were probably in the midst of a demographic bubble. So now, as you know, there's talk about closing several schools after we've just spent tens of millions of dollars yep. building them. So this is frustrating. All that says to me that, you know, the people you put into office or positions of power in town government matter. It's an inexact science governing a town, but you want people who are sincerely concerned, take a long view, and are willing to, you know, not just go with the political winds. Specifically affordable housing, we have things like 40B, and that's another one of those weird creations where it's for people who aren't familiar with it, it's a tool that allows developers to come in and get around normal zoning if they build affordable housing. But what counts as affordable, and this is true of all kinds of affordable, is based on a constantly shifting standard of what the average home costs are in the area and so on and so forth, which has some meaning. But if you're a person of very limited means, it may have very little meaning. It may, frankly, still may be pretty unaffordable.
Yes.
I think we need to try to sustain that as much as possible. It's good to have a community where a wide range of people of different means can live.
Agreed. Yeah, there's a bunch in there, and I appreciate at least having the time to go and follow that thread with you, because yeah, there's no simple solution, and they are all interconnected. You just can't do one without considering the other. And I think certainly the historical connection that we've had over time, and I think the perspective that the long view clearly is something that needs to be kept in mind for each decision. And to that end, yeah, you've been part of the open space plan, which was part of the master plan. Both of those are up for review in the next couple of years, if I recall correctly, by the timeline. So yeah, we'll have an opportunity to revisit those and say, okay, what do we really want to do now going forward where we are, considering, well, and especially with COVID, what's the post-COVID world going to be like? It'll probably be a little bit different than what we were going into.
Probably, I suspect. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's certainly concerning.
Very concerning, because that is probably the biggest unknown. Never mind when are we going to get out of it, but what is it going to look like by the time we get out of it?
Sure.
Yeah.
I agree.
So on another topic related in that, the Community Preservation Act is on the November ballot.
Yep.
Well, what do you think of that?
Yeah, it's funny. Jamie Helen was reminding me, our town administrator, that he came and spoke to us on the Open Space Committee back in the early 2000s about
that.
And of course, I have to confess, I've forgotten this, but I know someone came, but I didn't know it was the young Jamie Helen.
Oh, it was this young guy, right? At that time.
comparatively young Alan Earls was the listener. CPA could definitely help. But as you know, we had the chance to approve it 14 to 15 years ago. And as I recall, at that point, because the state was just launching it, the incentives were really outstanding. They had gold-plated it because they wanted to get people on board. And I think it's a shame we couldn't have done it then. And also in the meantime, you know, some great properties like that Pond Street former sewer site that got developed might have been preserved. So I think it can accomplish important things. But to your point about the post-COVID world, maybe it could be too little too late. I hope it can do some good. And we also have huge questions. What are we going to be facing in terms of priorities? And who knows? But it could be helpful. I hope it can be.
Yeah, because at least from my understanding of it, to the extent that it's not just preservation. Yeah, globally community preservation, but it has room for open space and recreation, affordable housing, which certainly is key. And
very key. Playground maintenance, all kinds of things that get lost in the shuffle oftentimes.
Right. And then, of course, the historical preservation itself. And picking up on one of the things we mentioned, and you mentioned particularly with the school study, certainly the Four Corners School was a nice town landmark that's gone now, replaced by, you know, kind of a generic Walmart, Walgreens. But if the planning were to continue going down between Davis Thayer, Parmenter and Kennedy, you've got three older schools that all have both interesting locations from a town perspective and could be really challenging as well as beneficial to the town if they're developed properly.
Yes, and that's where a long-term plan can come in. So I think it's really easy to take opportunities like that and maybe not make the ideal choice. I don't know what the answer is to what the ideal choice is, but I think it's something that takes a lot of input, a lot of thought, a lot of people's voices to try to get to.
Right.
When you have an opportunity like that.
Yeah, for sure. More to come on that one, for sure. Yep. And into the budget, the question is somewhat long because I want to make sure that all the listeners as well, I know you're fairly familiar with, but all the listeners get the full context of it. But back in 2019, it seems so long ago, the town administrator suggested we would need to consider an override measure. Obviously, the earlier this year, the pandemic hit and that never came to happen. But in the meantime, the water rate's gone up, the trash recycling rate has increased, stormwater utility fee is up for consideration for implementation on or about July 2021. And yet the operational budget for both school and town side is still challenged. So what are your thoughts on the financial struggles that we're facing? Yeah,
that's a nice gentle word, challenged. That's all my biggest, I think that's my biggest worry and probably my biggest motivation for being on the council. Again, not that I have the answers, but I see us facing some potentially pretty wrenching challenges. Again, it's hard to get a good grip on that. The, you know, all the budgets are in flux, but when we weren't facing an emergency like COVID or recession, the town unfortunately, you know, let its rainy day fund go rather than deal with some fiscal challenges that were, in retrospect, perhaps fairly minor a year or two back. As you know, when my son Eamon was on the council, he was, I think, the only person that voted against that, yep, rightly or wrongly. But now we don't have that rainy day fund. We probably could really use it.
Right.
I understand. I don't know the details, but I'm aware that the town has done some furloughing of staff, cutting on spending and so on, which is probably to its credit and good, but a matter of reacting rather than planning. And I think we need to start planning for maybe some leaner years. The last thing I personally want to see is an override, but given the situation we're facing, I don't know whether we're going to be able to get by without it. Again, I don't know the real numbers. But you know, we have to have schools, we have to have public safety, and if the money is not there, and again, that there's so many moving parts for that. As you know, we have limits on the rate we can charge for real estate, but as real estate values go up, which they have been lately, I think, because of, you know, strange new patterns driven by monetary policy, COVID and what have you, we've actually been doing comparatively well, but that could change. You know, interest rates could suddenly go up, people could stop buying houses, people could move out of town, rates, you know, it's complicated.
It is intensely complicated. I think
we may need to give, absolutely, but we may need to give voters that option to choose to override. But I think if we do, we really, really need a clear commitment to not just do business as usual. I can't throw stones at anybody in town government. I think there are a lot of great people in town government. But I don't see us striving for best practices. You know, looking at towns that have done amazing policing with less money or amazing schools with less money, it's just kind of like, this is the way it is, ramp it up 5% this year compared to last year. Kind of an aside, when I was a business journalist around 1990, I can't remember the gentleman's name, but Governor Dukakis faced a huge, huge fiscal problem. The state was billions in the red. No one knew what to do. And he brought in a very senior guy from one of the big accounting firms. And I got a chance to sit with this fellow because he wanted help in articulating what he was trying to do. Mm-hmm. For the business community,
sure,
so they would, yep, understand. And he made the very simple analogy, which always stuck with me, about how public spending usually goes. People think, well, we need better public services, we should spend more money. He said, when you go to, you know, Best Buy, you don't say, how much can I spend for that widescreen TV? You say, how much can I get for a certain amount of money?
Right.
And that's, of course, a gross oversimplification, but it's a reminder that all the spending we do can be put under a microscope and can be thought about, I think, more effectively. It takes time, it takes energy, it takes voters paying attention and thinking about issues that might be complicated. But we are probably going to need to do that if we want to get to an optimal place in a few years.
Yeah, I concur. And I think certainly from my observational role, the town, as much as it's done and how well it's done, particularly recently in terms of its communications, there's still a whole lot of stories to be told.
Yes.
So,
and I know from a number of people I've heard, including you, that the FinCom, year after year, does great work. The Financial Committee,
yes,
our Commissioner Committee, to dig into the budget and figure out, yep, what's working, what's not working, where the problem areas are. And year after year, the their recommendations are pretty much ignored, which is a shame. You know, they should be front and center in this, and people should know them by name. They should be, they're the stars. They really are on top of a lot of this stuff. So I would hope to help that happen if I get to be on the town council and make sure their voice is heard loud and clear so we can get to really good decisions.
Yeah, the FinCom, certainly in the budget cycle, has a unique role. It reports directly to the town council. It doesn't sit anywhere else. It reports to the town council as your additional arm, assuming you would get there, your additional arm to get into the details with each of the departments and, you know, provide that due diligence that respectfully, in some cases, you may not be able to as a town councilor, but they can provide that additional expertise.
Yeah. And that, I don't know if some of the reluctance to do that stems from the specific statement of mission that the town council has, which pulls it back very far from administrative duties. Yes. I don't know the details of that, but I believe about 20 years ago the town council was out of control. They had their fingers in everything. Mm-hmm. I think Jeff Nutting, if I remember correctly, got them to agree to a self-limiting not really a charter, but a statement.
Yeah.
And that's probably a good thing in general, but I think at times maybe it neuters, to use that old term, the town council too much, so they're not as involved as perhaps they should be, or as aware at least as they perhaps should be of some of the potential trade-offs and issues that are out there. And, you know, I think voters are looking for more activism after this, you know, unfortunate loss of $500,000, the ballot problem that have occurred in the primary election and things like that, that are not giving them a high sense of confidence that everything's running well in the town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So
that's where you get cynical voters from, unfortunately.
Lots of opportunities for sure. So the next and almost last question is, you know, if somebody's listened to this, they've got a better sense of you. And so what would you say to the voter who kind of wants that short one? Why should I vote for you?
Yes. I got a lot of that when I was out gathering signatures. It was a great process because there were some really good conversations. I guess it would be a start. I'd start with my simplistic slogan. I'm all in for Franklin. You know, I've rolled up my sleeves many times and in many different ways over the years, whenever I thought, rightly or wrongly, that I could contribute some kind of energy or ideas or work to get a problem taken care of or addressed. Conversely, I think I'm a pretty humble person. You know, I mean, I have my notions, but I listen to people, and I'm happy to admit that I'm wrong if you convince me I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're going to get to what's best for the town, you need some of that, because it's complicated, as we've said, very complicated, and it requires compromise, a lot of listening, and some experience. So I've shown myself willing to commit time and energy, and I think I've got a pretty good knowledge of the town. Not perfect, but I think it's a pretty good starting point for serving on the council. I don't think you'll find too many people that have been as committed as I have who aren't already on the council or in roles in town government.
Yeah, I think Justin, clearly, while we've been together in our paths have crossed, as we said a few times along the way, including moving the Trowbridge piano from the old South Meeting House to the Historical Museum.
Yes. An adventure.
Even during this conversation, I've learned other little bits and pieces of your background, et cetera, that I had not been aware of before. So hopefully others will find good things about you so they can make a good choice when December 5th rolls around. Is there something else that we haven't talked about that you would like to add so that they have that for a record?
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of pro forma. I want to thank you because you have been selfless. You're an unelected gem. You've put immense amounts of time into keeping people informed. One of the problems I think we have in this town, many towns have the problem, is we don't have a daily newspaper. I started my career as a writer at the Milford Daily News, covering Milford, and we covered it exhaustively. You know, I would attend Board of Health meetings. Nobody goes to Board of Health meetings.
Yep.
And my job was to find something interesting. Were they overspending on pencils? Did they do enough to make sure all the dogs in the town were healthy? people knew about everything in town because they had a daily newspaper. That's a historical artifact. You don't have that, but you come pretty close to delivering that to people, which is terrific. That's a really great start, because without it, the kind of information you provide, people can't make meaningful decisions. And beyond that, you know, I always encourage people to try to get involved, ask questions, and do come on December 5th. People will probably be pretty well politicked out after November, and the holidays will be coming up, but come on out. It can make a difference, and I hope you'll vote for me. I think I can do a good job for you.
Yeah, I haven't talked with the town clerk, and we'll get into more of it when I do talk with her shortly. But while I believe there won't be an early voting piece because the town doesn't currently have that funded, mail ballots will still be available. So while I know, and I think it was only 214 or 20 something votes in the last December town council special election, I would expect we're going to blow that away this year.
Yeah.
With, you know, yeah,
more involved.
Yes. Any number of reasons. And ease of access, you know, the mail vote, even on a Saturday election, between the two of them, we're going to go way beyond the 200. I wouldn't want to bet. I'm not a betting person. I just do the reporting. I don't do the forecasting.
Yes, fair enough. I would be the same.
Well, thank you for taking your time today and sharing your story with the Franklin voters. Hopefully they'll be that much more informed. We'll include in the show notes, I assume, your email, your website, any page you have that are campaign related. We can include those as well so people can follow along.
Sounds good. Appreciate that.
All right.
Thanks, Steve.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio, WFPR-FM. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana. Copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. You can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.